You can actually psych out some geology professors once in a while with concrete. Find it buried. But. So we have the Baraboo Hills. So the Baraboo Hills are ancient mountain range. So depending on who you talk to, they're like 1.5 billion to like 2.2 billion years old. They obviously look like small hills now, but the reason they are that way is because they've been subjected to erosional forces, the wind, the water, for a billion years or whatever. So, one of the oldest mountain ranges in the U.S. You know, the Rocky Mountains are big and jagged and rugged terrain because that's a very, geologically speaking, that's a very recent mountain range. Appalachians are a little older, so worn down, bigger than this, but still, you know, way worn down compared to the Rockies. So we have the Baraboo Hills quartzite. You can't see it so well from here. I should have pointed it out earlier, but southwest of us, and also like that natural bridge area, and that's actually the same geology as around La Crosse, where I think some of you are going later, or along the Mississippi. So that's the Driftless area. So that's like the start of the Driftless, or the extent of the Driftless geology in this area. So that's relatively young geologic formation, a couple hundred thousand years old, sedimentary rock, obviously sandstone, dolomite. Been eroding for years, and the bluff tops are typically that harder dolomite, and then there's sandstone underneath. Let's see. So the third one, actually, when we were driving here on that road that went north, as you were driving along on the right side, there was a big thicket of invasive species, trees and stuff. We were actually on came down from the northeast area, kind of swooped around the Baraboo Hills, came up, stopped right there, and so there would have been, you know, like a mile thick sheet of ice that came up to that point. Ahead of it, I mean, a sheet of ice like that is essentially like a big bulldozer pushing everything over in its path. That moraine is basically the end of the blade of the dozer blade, where it's a mix of huge glacial erratic boulders, gravel, mishmash of soil all jumping together, and they call that glacial till. So that's the terminal moraine from the last glacier. The Ho-Chunk land is actually, that formation is, it's a combination of things, but mainly when that glacier started to melt, you know, there was a sheet flow of water coming out of it, you know, spreading across the landscape as it melted and depositing sediments. Soils. That's why people farm it south of here. That's why the prairie got established. So the prairie actually came in after the glaciation period, probably about 6,000 years ago is when the prairie started to get developed. And that prairie actually came, would have spread from the western states and southern states up this way. You know, seed gets transported by various ways and eventually it got established. Prior to like glaciation, this whole area would have been, the climate would have been much cooler and wetter. It would have been more like a boreal forest kind of habitat. So a lot of spruce trees, tamarack, fir, not hardwoods that you see today. And in fact, mentioning that, now that we're standing here, you know, this is a solid, basically a solid woods of oak, hickory, and other species. Even they smooth the transition from the prairie on the flat, opening going up the slope, and then it's going to be mature forest on the state's land, because that's what all this is on up here. In the back?
I was curious who does the burning, and like, is the method in any way different because it involves like a Ho-Chunk perspective versus like other places?
So we do all our burning in-house, so it's a combination of our Ho-Chunk fire crew and then also the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So we have about 10 people that are federally certified, so you have to be certified to burn on federal land. So we do prescribe fire, but then people can also go out west on fire details for wildfires if they want to, and we do have people go out all the time. As far as the method, it's like we're using modern techniques, so it's like we have a couple brush trucks, we have UTVs set up with water on them, we have the drip torches if people know what they are. We actually have a UTV with a flamethrower on the back that shoots flame out, so you can, you know, I mean, we have long stretches of roads along the units we want to burn, so I mean, we'll literally go 10 to 15 miles an hour shooting flame off this UTV and lighting up, I mean, literally lighting an entire mile and a half of fire on the ground at one time. Mm-hmm. But no, there's no, there's nothing unique that we're doing related to the Ho-Chunk.
Yeah. Except that it's in Ho-Chunk, that Rand's Reclamation.
Right, yeah.
Except the whole politics of it.
Yeah, so we've been burning since... Our first prescribed fire was in 2015, the spring right after it transferred. We burned 500 acres, and it was pretty cool. I mean, like, the local community and the people into restoration were just, like, driving by, cheering. I mean, literally doing that stuff, and we're just like, yeah, this is great. And since then, we've been burning certain areas every year, and we've burned as much as 800 acres at a time, or over a couple days, you know, it's not at once.
What's your long-term perspective, having in mind that climate and vegetation zones will drive up north pretty quickly?
Right, so actually, we have a good feel for that, and actually the prairie that we're putting in is actually going to be more suited for the climate changes that we expected in this area, so we'll continue to put that prairie in the ground, and then as far as burning, it's... All the burning is really going to be timed based on what species are there and what our objectives are. You know, sometimes we're burning to remove invasive species. Other times we're burning to get the right combination of habitat for certain species. So some grassland bird species don't mind if you burn every year. Like bobolinks will be out here after you burn. There'll be hundreds of them flying around. Species like Henslow sparrow needs a really thick guff like we have right here to nest. These are all ground nesting birds, so they need a real thick mat of grass to lay their eggs. If they don't have that, they're going to move somewhere else to build nests. So what we really need to focus on in the future is timing our burns to promote as many species as possible. And you can't say there's like no one answer that's right. It's just looking at what other people are doing, reading the literature, and somewhat experimenting to get the right combination. And you don't ever want to burn the entire area all in one year. It's always about leaving refuge for certain areas, refuge for insects, things like that. So that's all stuff that we consider when we're doing these burns.
So what's the level of maintenance that you have to put into an area once you have developed it into prairie?
So, yeah, as far as basically right after we get the seed in the ground, that next year we have to mow it sometimes two or three times. So we're going out there with a tractor and a big, you know, it could be a 12 to 16 foot wide mower, and we're mowing that new prairie planting. To actually keep the weeds down that we don't want to get established. So even with the spraying that the farmer does, there's still a seed base there for all these weed species, and they come up right away as soon as, you know, it's open ground. So we're mowing to like clip off the For example, once the vegetation would get to be like 18 to 24 inches high, we'll cut it down to like less than 12 inches. And we'll do that the entire first summer, and sometimes even the second summer. The other thing that's going on is this warm season perennials, that whole first year, they're putting all their energy into making root structures, so they're not necessarily getting very tall at all, so they need a lot of help to be able to out-compete the cool season weeds that are, shoot up and get some. Every other year, or maybe even every year, if we need to keep knocking back that cool season stuff and make sure our warm season grasses get established. But once it's well established in a prairie, the timing is more like maybe 3 years, but realistically, maybe we're burning like every 5 years, even like out to 8, 10 years. I mean, if a site is looking, if it's well established, doesn't have invasive issues, doesn't have cool season grasses trying to invade. I mean, they can go for a while and just let that thatch build up, let those certain species that like that habitat, let them thrive there, and then maybe burn it, knowing that we have another spot that's already in that process of building up that thatch there. So. The other thing, you don't have to burn all the time, although that's preferred and it's a lot of fun. You can actually mow these sites too, and that's what a lot of private landowners do. Like if they have a small prairie they put in, it's scary burning stuff, especially on your own land when you're responsible for it. So you can actually mow it periodically to kind of mow the prairie and go about it that way. So.
Did the Ho-Chunks practice much agriculture, and if so, are they trying to return any of this land?
So the Ho-Chunk people are known for agriculture. They're one of the tribes that had raised garden beds and raised a lot of corn, and three sisters like the other tribes did. They're also known for having fishing camps in Spirit Lake up here in Dewakanchung, so, and also on the Winnebago over by Green Bay.
Uh-huh.
Tribe used to have fishing camps there, so it's fishing and ag. You hear a lot about wild rice in Wisconsin and Minnesota. The Ho-Chunk people, I'm sure back in the day they used to gather wild rice, but they're not a ricing tribe. Yeah, it's a Chippewa Ojibwe thing. As far as this parcel, there has been talk about growing Indian corn out here. Like, I get comments like, why are we growing field corn when we could have Indian corn out there? And it's harvested out of the Baraboo Hills to create these tunnels, and what they used them for is this building. They would set up these small cannons on turrets, and then they would test their powder that they made to make sure it fired the way they wanted it to and all that stuff. So they would actually periodically launch things into those cannon range tunnels as a test. So this is like a big thick blast wall. These structures weren't removed by the Army because they're not an environmental liability. So where they shot into those tunnels, they remediated the soil in there. Actually, the Sheriff's Department used to also use it as a rifle range and a pistol range. They got all that lead out of there, cleaned that up. But the concrete itself is not a liability, so the Army is not required to tear it down. So here it sits. We'd like to get this torn down at some point. It's probably going to be long off into the future. I'd like to just concentrate on our restoration work first. One cool thing that we're doing here, though, is with those cannon range tunnels, they're actually used as winter bat hibernacula. So the bats in this area, there's a bunch of species that hibernate. They don't migrate. So they actually use these cannon range tunnels in the wintertime. We'll go in there and we'll actually, and this is a joint effort with the Wisconsin DNR, we'll go in there and monitor the bats, count how many are in there, what species. Some of them actually have what they call pit tags in them, so radio tags, where they can run a little sensor over them. They can tell which bat it is because it's, each one's assigned its own unique number identifier.
What species are they?
So in these, there's typically big browns, little browns, and there's been, occasionally there's an oddball one here and there, pipistrelle. I'm sure most of you have heard of white nose syndrome. Mm-hmm. So this white nose syndrome is basically, I'm pretty sure every hibernacula in Wisconsin has white nose.
Mm.
We found it here about 3 winters ago. And that's really why there's big browns, because big browns are tolerant of white nose, and some of the other species are not so much. They'll actually die from it, but big browns can actually appear to tolerate it and survive. So, and there's not a ton of bats using these areas. I think, you know, there might be 50 at a time that we'll find in there. There's also another Army structure that we've converted to winter hibernacula. And that one's actually an underground concrete reservoir that's about 60 by 80 feet. And that used to hold water from the filtration plant after it was filtered. And so we basically put grates over the top that allow the bats to get in, and it keeps people out and keeps people from falling down into this cavern. So, and that one, we haven't had bats going in to use it yet. Part of the reason is we think that when they're eco-locating, when they fly in there, it's probably disorienting because there's so much concrete. So we're looking at ways to maybe improve that for the bats by either putting in some kind of sound baffles to break up the bounciness off the concrete. So. Any questions? I think we're just about out of time here. So.
Yeah, people can move.
They're supposed to. We'll see if they are on time.
Do you mind mentioning who your next tour are? If that was interesting.
Yeah. So I don't know the official name, but essentially it's a group of tribal attorneys that have a meeting at Ho-Chunk Casino, and their specialty is Indian land transfers. So they're visiting this site, of course, because it's a land transfer. And then... they're visiting some of the other mound sites. So they're going to Man Mound, which I think some of you went to or have heard of. And they have a couple of, Kingsley Bend is another mound site east of Dells and west of Portage that the tribe owns. That actually used to be an old DOT wayside that had effigy mounds on it. And the tribe acquired it from DOT and manages it now from the cultural resources. And that turns out that's actually another prairie restoration site that we have. So we burn that. We burn some
some of the mounds we burn over, most of them we don't. We go to Bill Quackenbush for direction on that. So.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be the Indian Land Tenure Foundation from Minnesota, or is this a different group?
I'd have to look. I'm
okay, just curious.
The one that set up the tour is Samantha Greendeer.
Okay.
So Samantha is actually one of the attorneys that worked for the tribe on this land transfer.
Okay.
So she just called me directly.